welcome you all to this Serial Formation Network opportunity to learn a little bit more about some of the theological considerations and practical concerns for ordinations, knowing that that is something that y'all are interested in. And in particular, I'm so glad for our colleagues who have come, who are were part of the group to reassemble a manual for ordinations and installations. And I'm going to put that actual document in the chat, but I'm going to invite Mary to introduce herself, and we'll start there.
Thank you, Michelle. Hi, everyone. I'm Mary Geer, and I serve as the minister for the Olympia Unitarian Universalist Congregation in Olympia, Washington. And there's a couple folks I recognize who have graced our pulpit here, so thank you for that.
Hello, everybody. My name is Jen Youngsun Ru, and I serve the congregation in Eugene, Oregon. I was ordained in 2006 by the Williamsburg, Virginia congregation.
That's the years, they fly by, don't they? I know that both Mary and Jen have been in ministries where celebrations have been delayed and postponed and elsewise managed because of this pandemic that we're in. And I know that you all are in the midst of formation. So I'd just like to invite you to drop a line in chat with where it is that you are geographically and where you are in your formation, if your ordination's coming up or if you're preparing for your first semester of midterms. It would be great to get a sense of who is with us. We, as part of this wondrous movement that we're part of, so many different ways that people approach these celebrations, these sacramental celebrations of ministry. And so I was eager for Mary and Jen to start us off with a little bit of the theological grounding that you brought to this project of recreating a manual that had been maybe sitting on the shelf for quite a while and was in need of some renewal and some updating, and what you found or what brought you into that project from a theological position.
Do you want to go, Mary?
Please, go ahead. Thank you.
Yeah, so you'll notice in the manual, the actual manual itself, and Michelle, did you already give them? There it is, right there. The manual starts off with a really wonderful logical foundation for both installation and ordination from the Unitarian side and the Universalist side. And so it's a really easy to read part of the manual. So, you know, basically ordination used to be, like, they go into the history. We covered the history, the early Christian history of the very hierarchical understanding of ordination, that ordination was from God, actually, and people were ordained by God, and then takes us through that history to where we are now and our understanding as not a non-hierarchical event where it is the congregation that has the power to ordain, and it's not that they are setting someone above others, but the churches are setting apart someone that they have identified as someone having gifts of the Spirit. Now that definitely comes from the Christian tradition, the idea of discerning gifts and a community discerning the gifts of someone that's among them, and then kind of setting them apart and saying and recognizing that you have these certain gifts.
When it came time for your ordinations, and knowing that there's such a discernment of the community that calls you, it sounds like you both had different ways of being called. Mary, you had two congregations ordaining you. I wonder if you could say a few words about how you made that determination and what that meant for you.
Sure. So I was ordained in February of 2018. So I just had my ordination anniversary last week. And just wanted to mention, for me, there were these series of transitions. I graduated from Star King in May of 2017. I saw the MFC in September of 2017. I was ordained in February of 2018. It's not that linear for folks. And for me, it was important to have some time in between each of those thresholds, just to kind of catch my breath for crossing each of them, because each of them was a big deal. And the ordination for me was in recognition of a couple things. One was that the Salem, Oregon congregation was the place where I had worked on staff and attended seminary, and was a place that really nurtured me in my formation as a minister, although I'd heard the call to ministry some years before. The Portland, Oregon First Unitarian in Portland, where I was working at the time, was also important in my formation. It had been where I did my congregational internship. And so for me, it was important to have both of those congregations present, because they both were important in that transition and that formation process for me. So in talking with both the ministers and the boards in both of those congregations to discern, is this something that would make sense for them as it made sense for me? And I just, one of the other things that was kind of nice is I got to have two parties, one in each city. So that was nice too.
I really like that, because it harkens back to the way the Universalists used to do ordination, right? It wasn't just one congregation, but it was the whole denomination ordaining you. And so that Mary's example gets a little closer to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the other things that was important to me was just that idea of, it is a congregation that ordains. And our congregational polity really says it's the congregation that recognizes our call. So we have our own sense of our call and what that might be like in the world. And in our faith tradition, it's important that congregations recognize that call in us as well.
I'm aware that at this time, a lot of folks are going into community types of ministries. And I'm wondering about, in your compilation of things, and both in the history and to some extent the current practices, where one is not called into a congregation, but into another manifestation of a vocation, what are some of the considerations folks might open up to in terms of who would be the appropriate ordaining body, or anything that should go along with that discernment?
I know here in Olympia, we have people who are in various phases of formation right now. And when I was beginning the path to ministry, the congregational endorsement came pretty far in the process. And I'm actually happy to see that it's earlier in the process now, because that congregational relationship, I think, is important for everyone, including community ministers, for a grounding in a faith tradition and in a community of some kind. And so here in Olympia, we have a community affiliated minister, Reverend Carol McKinley, who has been affiliated here for forever. This is the congregation that Carol grew out of, attended seminary through, and the congregation that ordained her in. She has remained an affiliated community minister. So even at age 80, I have the benefit of this amazing colleague with a strong social justice calling. And so Carol, for me, is kind of the lived example of what it means to be in the community and grounded in a congregation then that helps with that support. And what Carol does in her community service, she also brings back to the congregation as well. So there's this flow of energy and such back and forth.
And I've seen a really beautiful ordination service for a community minister, where it was the congregation, of course, expressing and practicing its polity and doing the ordaining, but then the nonprofit agency, the executive director and some staff people from that nonprofit, they were also there to be part of the ceremony.
And I would just mention one of the examples in the handbook is Crystal Zerfoss's ordination, which included not only investiture of a stole, but of a clerical collar, and recognition of Crystal's community ministry and how they show up in the community realm, which was the first time I'd seen that, and it was really lovely and very meaningful to see that happen. So I think that there are some ways to kind of hold up that community ministry and how that looks different in the world within the liturgy of the ordination service.
I'm going to invite us to turn to questions in a couple of minutes, but before we do that, I know that there's a lot of things that are the same and a lot of things that are open for innovations. And Mary, I had asked you to speak in particular about one, and that might be a launch pad to starting to collect some other questions from folks that are here in the Zoom room with us.
Sure. So Michelle asked me to speak about the left hand of fellowship, which I changed in my ordination service to extending the hands of collegiality. And so why did I do that? And for me, you know, as in any liturgy, the question is, what's the purpose of something, some part of it? How does it fit into the whole? And what's the meaning? And for me, the left hand of fellowship had a lot of meaning that didn't seem to fit for me. The idea of fellowship and the left hand of fellowship, the shaking of hands, felt to me like a very masculine, hierarchical, patriarchal gesture and part of the ritual. And so I was in conversation with the person I asked to extend that hand. That was Bill Sinkford. And Bill and I had a conversation about what this particular part of the ritual meant from his perspective and from mine. And I remember saying to him, Bill, for hundreds of years, ministers didn't look like me. And while I understand that I'm receiving a lineage and want to acknowledge the importance of that lineage in this process, it's also about being welcomed into a ministry that looks very different because we're a living tradition. And so is there a way to craft a ritual that really is about accepting that lineage and a promise of helping us to move into whatever it is that we are becoming at the same time? And so together we crafted this ritual of extending the hands of collegiality. The words are also important, as you know, and fellowship is a UUA word in my mind. You know, there's the whole fellowship process and preliminary fellowship and full fellowship, which is different than the congregational process. And so to me, it was also important to separate those things, and it made it way easier to explain to congregations what was happening and what that meaning meant. So does that answer your question, Michelle, and where that came from?
It does. You know, it is interesting to think about the things that have become sort of norms, like gift giving, or having certain people, certain roles for certain people in one's life, that when I look back at my own ordination program recently, like, oh, I didn't do all of the right things. But I think, like you described, Mary, have some theological concerns about elements that back in those days, I think, fit in that question of what is this and what's the meaning behind any one of these deliberate types of action. It does seem like congregations, there are just such a mix of congregations that have ordained or brought a lot of folks into leadership, and congregations that this is the first time or maybe the only time that they're doing something like that. And Jen, am I right that your ordination happened when you were newly called to your first congregation?
Yes. And so my example was one of ordination and installation at the same time.
And did that have particular meaning, or was that something you had intended because of timing or geography, or there are things that went into that decision different than ordaining and any of your teaching ministries?
So it was timing and opportunity. So my home congregation is First Unitarian Baltimore. And you know, when I was going through formation, I always thought, oh, it would be the Baltimore congregation that would ordain me. And I looked forward to that. But then as I was in the search process and just falling in love with this wonderful congregation in Virginia, I thought, oh, it's better to do it this way, you know, to start a brand new ministry, brand new settled ministry with them getting to do this. And it was important to them too. Like, it was something they were looking forward to. They hadn't done it for a really long time. So it made sense for me. There's a question in the chat that I can go ahead and answer. So about ordination for military chaplaincy and not being affiliated with the church. So only the UU congregation can ordain you, period. So you can't ask, like, if when you're in the military, you can't ask anyone there to ordain you, because it's your faith community that's ordaining you. And so you would have to find a UU congregation somewhere, and you don't have to be affiliated with that church necessarily to ask to be ordained by them, but it would have to be a UU congregation somewhere.
I think that is one of the tricky things that we do talk about, having connections with congregations in so many different ways and at so many different times in the formation and afterwards process when we're going through fellowship renewals, having relationships with congregations. And it can look like a lot of different things for different folks, but I'm hopeful that I know that you all have questions, and in particular, you might be good resources for each other, because planning ordinations in pandemics is not something that has been thought about a lot in historical precedents. So I'm glad to monitor a queue of folks who would like to ask any particular questions or raise any innovations that you've seen that are intriguing and impressive, or that you're interested in applying to your own transition into an ordained status.
So I do have an innovation that I thought I would mention. Up this way in the Seattle area, summer, I attended an ordination. It was online. There were folks gathered in person, but it was primarily online, of two people who were ordained at the same time. And they were ordained by five congregations. Yeah. So it was Matt Aspen and Joe Rettenmeyer, both who had been community ministers. Victoria, you might have been there as well, and were connected to these five congregations who all came together to honor and ordain these two people. It was a lovely service, and that was the first time I'd seen so many congregations in conversation and two people ordained at the same time. And it was very meaningful for them to have that kind of community presence.
Yeah, Joshua.
Yeah, as I think about my ordination, thank you all for sharing this helpful information. Mine will be July 2nd. It's already been scheduled. And, you know, I became a UU when I started seminary. So much of my formation prior to seminary was in the Jewish faith, was as a humanist, was et cetera, et cetera. My siblings are from different faiths. Some of my mentors are from different faiths. So I'm being ordained to the UU congregation, but I'm hoping to have people from other faiths participate by the lens of their own faith. Is that done?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a balance between this being the Joshua show, right? And this being a really important activity of the congregation. Right. And it is really important for you to be able to express your creativity and your personality and your faith tradition and your heritage and your culture and all of those things. So definitely bring all of those elements in while you're collaborating with the ordaining congregation.
So Joshua, if I might offer an example for my ordination, part of the service was prayer, if you will, from the teacher for the Sangha that I participated in, the Zen Buddhist Sangha, which had its home in the Salem congregation where the service took place. And so it wasn't just about my beliefs and practices, but it was about the whole community that existed there that was a part of this Salem UU congregation and beyond.
It reminds me that for my ordination, I was not going to have a laying on of hands for all the theological reasons that my humanist heart brought to the planning process. But I did have my best friend, who's an Episcopalian priest, offer a prayer that felt like a part of the broader community. We were serving in neighboring congregations at the time. And that there just are so many different ways that folks approach involving folks from various traditions, and whether it's a personal connection or institutional connection, that there are a lot of really lovely ways of seeing to it that the authenticity of the ministry and the minister are represented there. And Mary, when you spoke of the installation of the ordination of two folks side by side, a very specific question came to me about when they did their ordination vows, promises, did they do the same ones like sequentially, or was it both like a both I do and we do, or it might be too specific to have a recollection about?
I think they did them separately, but if anybody else was there and remembers differently, I'm open to that as well. But I think they did them individually, Michelle.
It's one of those things that I think really is so fascinating, and that I loved about the manual, really calling for just so much thoughtfulness about it, because I do remember going to dozens of ordinations in a certain phase of time where everybody had the same, made the same promises, which didn't make sense to me, but it was the way everybody did it that way. And so really parsing out some of the reasons why we do the things and what kinds of questions might go into deciding how one frames and enacts each of these elements of the ritual seems very moving, an opportunity both to get overwhelmed with details and to really make sure that there's congruity with one's beliefs and the community that's doing the ordaining along the way. And I know some of you have ordination dates on the book, it looks like, at this point. And I wonder if there are specific technical questions. I know budgets come up a lot.
One of the stories I'll just share, I was at an ordination that was about 6 months before mine, and the ordination was headed into its second hour. One of the elder ministers that I had processed with leaned over to me and said, "Mary, 75 minutes max, remember that." So just passing that on.
So Victoria has a hand, and then we've got a question from Jennifer too.
Yeah, along the lines of budget and talking about pandemic ordinations, I'm wondering if you'll have any thoughts on managing expectations, because as soon as I approached my congregation about an ordination, all of the hopes and dreams of pre-pandemic came forward, and I am exhausted. I do not have energy for managing an entire ordination planning committee, let alone flying people in and getting airfare. So, but I do want to have something that's meaningful for the congregation and for me. So curious to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, what would it be like to tell your planning committee that you just want a smaller, more modest affair? Are you saying that would be hard to say to them? It would be disappointing to them?
My sense is that there's a longing to have a celebration and have something fun to do after some pretty arduous years and some heated conflict within the congregation.
Yeah, so you don't want a party at all after the service?
Right now, I like the idea of the party more than the reality of planning the party. I think that's all I'm saying. I'm seeing a few smiles here. I hope I'm not alone in this.
And so even though they say, "Oh, we're excited, you know, we'll help you, you have a feeling that it's going to really fall heavily on you to make it happen. Oh, yeah. I think it's so important at the very beginning to just say, this is what I have in mind. This is, yeah. And just to set those expectations really early. And who knows, they may come through, you know? Some of those folks may have a burst of energy and say, "Don't worry about it. We'll take care of it."
I think that there is an openness too, I think, in within the communities, within institutional settings, to think about when an ordination takes place. So something that happens on a Sunday morning is not outside of the question. It changes who might be involved colleague-wise, but it might, a Sunday morning with a really special luncheon or special coffee hour might feel different than a 4 p.m. flying people in kind of occasion. And that could be something to consider. And yeah, we don't really have district events, but sometimes like a region, there's a regional gathering or something that has some time that colleagues are gathering and or training or a big, you know, important justice event that people are going to be there for that might offer an organic opportunity for something that is a connected event to bring people together, but it's not necessarily all about the ordination. It's about the broader community. That might be something. I see Joshua's hand and then a question from Elizabeth. Jennifer Springsteen.
Yeah, I'm curious about budget as well and where the money comes from. You know, I've raised someone. When the board decided to ordain me, they had an interim minister who came up and said, no, Joshua needs to raise the money. This is a brand new minister interim who is now separated from the congregation, who sort of pushed the idea that it was up to me to find the money. That's fine with me. I just didn't know that that was necessary, his place to do that. But so I did a fundraiser and I raised a certain amount, which I think is enough. But what I'm asking is, can anyone share, if it's okay, how much they spent on their ordination? So I know if, you know, what I've raised is even close to being reasonable. And we're going to do it as small as possible too. My congregation, after losing a minister and an RE, getting an interim minister, losing that interim minister, they're tired. They're very tired too. So we're just going to do this as simple as possible. But I'd like to know maybe what a reasonable number is.
So I don't remember the number off the top of my head. Jennifer Hackett, maybe you remember. We set aside money in the budget. It was $3,000. Is that the right? Yeah, it's $3,000. And it is absolutely the church's responsibility to make room in their budget for that and to find that money. It's our responsibility, you know, it's our obligation, it is our privilege to be the ordaining congregation. And so I think 3,000 is kind of middle high. I don't know, what would you say, Mary? Because we're factoring in, you know, flights for special guests, hotel room, a reception. A lot of it is travel costs and accommodation.
Yeah, I was thinking, Joshua, it really depends on what it is you plan. If you do an all online ordination, that can be pretty inexpensive. It really is travel and housing that's the most expensive piece much of the time. You know, I've seen all online ordinations during this pandemic where there are things mailed out to folks who register so that they can participate in the ordination in some way. And so there would be a cost to that, but that's really different than, you know, a flight and hotel and such for someone. So it seems to me that the question of cost, before that has to come a decision about what's the format going to look like and what really are the needs.
You know, it occurs to me that so much has changed, Mary, since we published this, right? And Erica went ahead and did a 2020 update and just, I mean, this manual is not that old. And the world has changed so much. Because back then we were still thinking about fair and honorarium for preachers and musicians compensation and for invitations and little gift baskets for participants. Ordinations where like every single person who processed got a little gift bag, flower, thank you card, all of that. And I think now, almost post-pandemic, it almost feels like too much. You know, feels a little gaudy somehow.
Yeah, I mean, Michelle, when you mentioned that this was an update a long time coming, I think the manual we were the only manual we had was what, 1984 from Peter Rabel out of Seattle. So when we revisited this in 2019, was it 2018, 2019, and here it's out of date already again, because the world changed. Yeah, I guess I would mention, so here in Olympia, we're planning an installation for June. I'll be installed in my third year here because of the pandemic. And we worked really hard and went through several venues to find a place that has both inside and outside, depending on the pandemic and the weather, and can stream from both places so that we can be a multi-site installation. That's not a small thing. And it's a lot to put that together. And that's a really different planning. You know, I've had the installation part of this manual out, and there's a whole bunch of other things added because of the multi-platform piece of that. So I don't know, Jennifer, maybe we need to do a post-pandemic update.
That's a project for everybody on this call to help support.
Next generation.
Jennifer asked the question about what elements are essential to ordinations. And I think that probably the act of ordination is essential, and that everything else has some real optional qualities to it in terms of, as I had mentioned, sort of doing it within a Sunday service or at some other kind of gathering, what's required. And I think there's also the reality that within our tradition, required is not the right word, but there is a technical thing about the having an ordination certificate. Oh, and then I see Elizabeth has a question about music, but technical things that one might want to keep in mind in advance of a ceremony at any time or place. Are there certain things, like where do you get the certificate?
You have to register your ordination with the UUA. So that's like an official thing with the UUA that they want to know. And then they will send you something, right?
Yeah, there's a certificate that you get, and there's certain people that have to sign it. So
right, like the board president.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but let me see if I can find mine real quick, because I think I scanned it and sent it in. But it seems like there's participants from the service that have to sign it as well, in my recollection.
Right.
Yeah. 4 years ago was like forever ago. So let me see.
I wonder if that might be something being updated as folks are having different roster of presenters in a ordination that's not hand of fellowship, ordination prayer, sermon. There might not even be a single sermon, though there, I think in the manual, a lot of good reasons for understanding the context of a sermon being about the ministry, not the person. Register before, like a wedding license? No, not like a wedding license, because it's only with the UUA, and it's the I think the main purposes for it are for the directories and historical counting of...
Sorry, I meant, do you need it in hand before the ceremony, or it's just a formality to make it official with the UUA?
Formality to make it official.
Thank you.
Right. So I'll drop in the chat. This is a form that they ask you to fill out, the UUA. So they say that they just ask you to notify their office of ordination. Once the ordination date has been set, an ordination certificate may be requested by completing this form that I dropped in the chat.
Thank you.
And curious about licensing for music. And my impression is that that would be the same for any, the way that your congregation approaches music for any Sunday service.
That's what I hoped. Thank you.
I know that that's also been a major consideration for folks who want to have special music in terms of budget, and that can sometimes be something that a congregation has a choir or has musicians, but it might be an extra service. And so thinking about honoraria for those professional folk coming in to do something, be something that the congregation just takes on in their regular budgeting, or with special guests might be something to consider for how to compensate them. The act of ordination is the only required part to be ordained. We are in consensus that it is.
Yeah, it's where the congregation refers to ordain. I don't know if that's the right word that I'm using. The congregation, yeah, reaches out and says, we have called you out, we have called you forth. And then the ordinand says, yes. That's the only part that's required or necessary to make it a real ordination.
And it's a little bit like when I am working with people to plan a wedding, state law requires that I declare them married and sign the marriage license. Everything else is, you know, what do you want the state to look like? We don't have a liturgy for weddings. And so it's a little bit like that for the ordination. There's this thing, this ritual that needs to happen, and all the rest is, so what's the meaning and purpose of that? And while I can, I did pull up my ordination certificate, and it has a place for the people who participated to sign, who gave the sermon, the prayer, who's the clergy to the minister, the clergy to the people, the right hand of fellowship, and who did the greetings from the denomination. And it was the moderator, the president of the congregation, that signed the actual certificate, if that's helpful.
What a great question about common pitfalls to avoid other than going on for 2.5 hours. I think that's a great question. I wonder what wisdom there is in the group.
So I've seen real problems when the ordinand kind of runs ahead of the congregation. So runs ahead of the leadership of the congregation and starts planning a whole bunch of things when the lead minister of that church, for example, didn't really know what was going on and was caught off guard and surprised, like, oh, all these things are happening, and they didn't know that was happening. Or resources from the church were being promised for this event, but others didn't know about those: staff, building resources, ability resources, you know, music resources. So lots and lots and lots of communication. There is a large section in the manual about relationships and taking care of relationships. And it's very, very detailed for a reason, because all of those were pitfalls that people had experienced when they didn't pay attention to certain relationships.
I think relationships in all of the rituals, when you mentioned weddings, Mary, it makes me think about the folks who are so occupied on the day of the ceremony that they're not present to their spouse or partner. At ordinations, there can be a tendency for folks who have put so much time and effort into planning to want to micromanage things, but there is a tradition of having a marshal, somebody who is taking care of some of those functional details. And again, with the virtual versus in-person kind of thing going on, I wonder if there's any wisdom of what's essential to hand off to somebody else on the ordination or celebration day. Seating charts were definitely something that I have seen clergy or clergy family being very over-invested in.
Like weddings.
Exactly.
I've always seen the marshals be the host, you know, greeting all of the visitors, visiting ministers, you know, all of the colleagues, making sure they know where the robing room is, where the bathroom is, and all that.
Joshua asked about having multiple identities within our ordination. And I think it's not unlike people that might be a certified chaplain and a parish affiliate and having many different identities and how one lists them, abundance of features to one's identity rather than a changing of any of the relationships, unless something, I don't know, the military questions, Ian, in particular, strike me as sometimes there are particular protocols one would need to follow with being called chaplain or reverend, or you, how to use particular titles. And informal situations?
I was asking because the Humanist Society is technically a church denomination, and that's how they are able to certify as what they call it celebrants. But essentially, I was ordained by them. So it would be like being, you know, ordained a Jewish rabbi and a UU pastor. I don't think I can do both, can I? Or
yeah, I think you can.
Polity wise,
we've got colleagues who are duly ordained.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Yeah, and our fellowship requirements aren't for where it comes into play for dual identities to authorized or somehow comes in the calling to a congregation. So somebody might need to be work on an agreement as a UCC minister serving a UU congregation, but that's more because of the particulars of a regional denominational body than most anything else. But there are a lot of dual ordained folks in our ministry and serving in congregations of all sorts. Questions, last chance for questions with our guests. I know that there's always things that come up in the conversations that we have, and that's part of the beauty of a resource like this wonderful thing that you've been part of and that is available on the UUA website. And maybe we'll have an addendum before too long. And that there is so much that's going to continue to change because of the pandemic nature. And I just so appreciate the description of, you know, things that feel like, is that necessary anymore? You know, hand inscribed invitations and lots of traveling. These are things that have feels like been maybe positive consequences of these times where considering our values has really shown up in very particular ways. A timeline for planning an ordination, it has varied, it seems, from a year out to just a few weeks to a certain number of months. Just like planning weddings, people do it on various time frames. Would that seem accurate?
Yeah, I mean, we used to say 6 months out, right? But if we're gonna simplify things now, you're not gonna need 6 months.
And it may be more about when the ordinand and the congregation are ready and kind of understand what it is that's coming. And so, you know, as an ordinand, when would you be ready physically, mentally, spiritually for that rite of passage? What came to mind for me is here in Olympia, where I'll be, you know, we'll have an installation. It's been 20 years since this congregation installed a minister. And so one of the things we're doing this spring is some reflection circles for the congregation to think about what does it mean to install a minister? Because many folks have never experienced that. And to me, that is as important for the preparation of the installation as the details of what that day is going to look like.
Yeah, I agree with you, Mary. Congregations need a lot of education about their authority in this matter. You know, it's the one thing that they alone can do.
Jennifer asked a final question about forming a committee for ordination, whom to ask and how. The best party planners, anybody that has all Martha Stewart books on their shelf can be a very helpful person. Other thoughts? Folks you like to work with?
Folks who will help you let go a little bit on that day when you need to, people you trust.
People who love you dearly and just want the very best for you.
The drawback of an intern committee might be in this category of their gift, particular gifts and graces.
They may not overlap, right?
Folks who are intent on being critical might not be the folks that are best party planners or best ritual designers. But he said Ian's hand is up. Yes, I see it now.
Yes, hopefully this can be a really quick question. I know we're low on time. I noticed that quite a bit of people seem to have their ordinations kind of, it seems like maybe a couple of months after meeting the MFC. So I'm curious about the etiquette of planning your ordination before passing the interview. If someone could speak to that.
Given that I'm going to see them for a second time, I would not advise it. There's a lot of assumption.
Although, can't a congregation ordain anyone they want, regardless of UUA imprimatur or not?
They can, and had the experience of serving a congregation while I was in seminary as a quarter-time contract minister, and they wanted really bad to ordain me so that I would stay with them. And there was a lot of education on their part and for them, and discernment on my part, because I can't say that it wasn't tempting to bypass all of that. And there are consequences to that, and it was important to me. And the basis of all that is the relationship, right? The relationship to my colleagues, the relationship to this faith tradition that I feel called to, my relationship to my call. And so it's not a small thing to discern that, I don't think. And I've had a couple of folks ask me, well, can't we just be working on the ordination before I go to the MFC? And in practical terms, I mean, there's the considerations for sure. In practical terms, what I said to them is, so what do you want to be focused on right now? And I would suggest it be the MFC.
So much to consider and so much more to have conversation about. And I do want to thank Jen and Mary so much for taking the time to be with and give blessings for you for your guidance and leadership in this project to make this manual come to us for ongoing support. And I want to be able to have us all give thanks and let you go. I'll offer up a few more formation network items for those who want to stay, but it's always a delight to have the chance to be with colleagues and to keep asking the questions, knowing that everybody that we're in relationship might have a different opinion, but we do have a good source for some of the grounded material that has gone into the thoughtfulness about how we approach these rituals and what it means for us and for our movement and for the good colleagueship that we share. So thank you, thank you, thank you. For those of you who got the latest UU MFN mailing, you know that we've got a couple of retreats on the book in the first weekend of April. The intention for this one is to continue to have retreats happening online because, you know, but to have the opportunity for folks to gather, like at Institute recently, some folks gathered in hotel rooms or beach houses and were able to log in together so that you could have the opportunity to be with other folks while having the program components virtually. And then coming soon to a registration form near you, we'll have the details of the gathering, which again, as long as we're going to be gathering UUA and UUMA in person in June, there'll be an in-person retreat those days prior to ministry days in June. So keep an eye out for that. I've talked with a few of you that the registration is not available for that yet, but along with 3 days registration early mid-March, those things will come out and you'll get mailings about it, but you can always reach out to me if other questions come up. And I'm just so glad that you all are here. And thank you, thank you, thank you for being here and for continuing to be part of this network as we grow and support each other.
Thank you, Michelle.